you mind if I leave here?
You can leave me where you want. Okay. So, this room is completely inappropriate. I'll see what I can do. I'm also assuming that the lecture tonight will be difficult, and I suspect maybe half of you will disappear, because the idea of Hegel is attractive, but the reality is somewhat different. The phenomenology is textual. Simply textually is, you know, sentence for sentence, the hardest philosophical book I know of. And if you really, I mean, do you really all want to do this? It is really stressful. But at any rate, we will see how it goes. We will find another room. We will do all those things. The first thing I want to do, I want to be sure that all the people who are registered for this course have a syllabus. Do you all have a syllabus? And do all the people who are registered for the course also have this single sheet about the mini commentary schedule? No? Is that still going around? There are some there. You want to pass them forward? If not, Rocio will do some more at halftime. This is Rocio Zambrana. She will be the TA for this. As you can see, I'll need some help. And I will obviously put in a request for a different room. Okay, let me just find out of the registered people who is here, and then I'll say something about the mechanics of the course. Christina Acosta. Hi. Juliana Agoli. Hi. Elizabeth Atkins. Avita Bansi. Sequestered there. Cameron Basiri. Sarah Baxley.
Sarah Nicole.
They just gave you an N. But you're Sarah Nicole. Okay. That is absolutely fine. That's the other thing, you know, since I'm just calling out names, you can change your name. You can be called anything you want. This is a great opportunity for that. Scott Belcher.
Here.
Thomas Bretz. Jacob Browning.
Here.
Matthew Congdon.
Here.
David Craig.
Here.
Cameron Crane. Come on in. Jason Pizzette.
Jason.
Richard Flynn.
Right here.
Ashley Garvey, Adam, please. Shem Goel,
yes.
Edward Gomo, Christopher Haddix, Callie Handelman, Maria Hetman. Christopher Hightower, Rika Josephson, Kathleen Kelly, Todd Kesselman, Thomas Krell, Catherine Legg, Brendan Mullally, Robin Muller,
hey,
Ben Olson,
right
Stephen Orr, Christopher Penfield, Matthias Peters, Joshua Panetta, Alexei Proshin, Robert Ramos, Daniel Restrepo, Karen Sedan, Barry Simon, Spear, Scott Shushin, Spear, Tomas Skolin, Anna Strelis, Keith Whitmoyer, there you are, and Angus Woods. Anyone else who's registered for this course whose name I have not called out? Can you just show your hands if you are just auditing? Yes. Okay. I warn you, we will do this. If I cannot find a room, I will have to exclude auditors for obvious reasons. So we'll give this a week and see how it shakes out. But the 45 people who have registered for this course, you know, get first dibs. So, and this is not workable as it is for the whole year. So we will see how it goes. But first, obviously, I have first responsibility. The students are really registered for this course. So we'll do it that way. Okay. I want to do some business things. Again, this is with respect to those who are in this course. The first thing you want to look at is the very, very long syllabus.
Gemini syllabus.
Is there any syllabi floating around? Get more than a half time as well. Okay. So there are two required texts for the course, Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit in the Miller translation and Hegel's On Christianity, Early Theological Writings. We will be starting with that text next week. Both of those should be in Barnes & Noble on 18th Street and, of course, easily available from Amazon. As I just said, Hegel's text is just the surface texture of it. The writing of it is brutally difficult. You will not even want to attempt to read it without at least one, and I always suggest probably more than one commentary. And I've said something about all the various commentaries here, so I've given you, and they are all also on reserve in the library.
The text.
Not the text, just the commentaries.
Like photocopies of section 2.
Nope. Got to get the books. This is commitment. You're going to have these books, and you'll be teaching them for the rest of your life. So this is got to get
them. Yeah,
I thought it was going to be something. No, it doesn't work that way. If you are feeling really unsure about it and really want a leg up to begin with, then I recommend Robert Stern's Hegel and the Phenomenology of Spirit. That is the best introductory commentary. It is clear, it is perspicuous. The best thing to use it for is actually to read it before you read the text. So you do not get lost in the text. And it is helpful and fine and good and, you know, all those kind of virtues. Once you are thinking hard about any topic, as you'll see, I give you masses of things to look at for each topic. But the two best commentaries are the classic one by Hippolyte, which is still staggeringly great, and now H.S. Harris's two-volume Hegel's Ladder, which is a really paragraph by paragraph reading of the book, and gives both for each paragraph of the book he gives both a kind of short restatement and then gives you all the historical references it could contain. I mean, it's a kind of welter, but it's also a reading, a very clever reading. And it is part of what you will see to be the contemporary, we'll simply call deflationary readings of Hegel. That is, these are all, and you will be exposed to an anti-metaphysical reading of Hegel. Hegel has no such thing called the absolute. There is no such thing as, the one that expresses itself. Everything, for example, that Charles Taylor says about Hegel is false. That's a good, if you want to read Charles Taylor's sentence, Chuck is a friend of mine, so be quiet about that, but sentence by sentence, almost every sentence is false. So if you just put a negation, you'll probably... And that's actually the way Hegel thought, too, right? That's the way he actually used to say showing. So I'd say something about all the rest of these commentaries. They all have different strengths. For those of you who are coming out of this having really worked your little butts off on Kant, the book that's changed Hegel's discussion in the Anglo-American philosophical world is Pippin's Hegel's Idealism. That's the book that does the Hegel as the completion of Kant, and a version of that. He's a bit too epistemological for me, but a version of that is the version we'll be doing in this course. Okay, so you need to acquire for yourselves the text and a commentary or two. The second thing, now turning to the mini commentaries by organization, is because this text is so hard, what you want to be doing, and what you in fact must do, for those who are interested in the course, is write commentaries, short, 500 to 750 word phrases in your own words of the various sections. And I recommend that you do this for each of the topics we cover. If I were you, I'd write one a week, but the rule is you must write at least four. And what I'm going to ask is for all the people who are registered in the course, I did this last year with the Kant, and it kind of worked rather well, so I want to try this again. We're going to have a break after about an hour. One thing, we all need air. And at that point, I want you to gather up with three or four friends to form a study group. Everyone is going to be in a study group. And the idea behind the study groups, first of all, you should know that in 1788, Hegel shared a room with Schelling and Hölderlin. They were roommates. They just know one another, right? They were roommates at a college, right? Studentship was state. Now, you need to be working through this text with philosophical friends. So you need to have a study group. And the study group, you can write your commentaries and then you exchange them amongst yourselves. And in that way, you can kind of check whether you are keeping up or your friends can tell you you're not, but kind of people you are working through the text with, you can either meet in person or online. But one thing you want to do, so at halftime, if you all could form yourselves in study groups and then just give me a slip of paper with your names of four or five people who are going to be in your study group. And then, the next order of business, is during the first 5 weeks of the semester, I will give you next week, I will give each of the study groups a number. And each week I'll have, as you see, some of you submitting your mini commentaries to me. The weeks that you're not submitting to me, you can be submitting to Rossio, and you must submit the three other required commentaries to her. The requirement is you must write four commentaries. You will not get a grade on your essay until you have written four commentaries. And the point is, of course, not to do this at the end. The whole point is this is to be, it's just, you know, getting you writing, thinking clearly about the text. And these will actually form little bits of what you're going to write your essays on. Okay, and then at the end of the semester, you can write an essay, and I will grade that. Okay. Any questions about class mechanics? Okay. Good. So the deal is we will, I'm going to chat for about an hour. We'll have a break, and then I will chat for another hour or so. So this will This will drift on. The nice thing about the 8 o'clock slot is it can go on till, well, not 1 or 2 in the morning, but anyway. Scared you, didn't I? Yeah. Now they throw us out. But we'll drift on to 10:15, 10:20, 10:30, something like that. The guy gets kind of ratty after 10:30 and it gets cross. Okay, what I want to do today is offer a introduction, mainly epistemological, mainly about the relationship between Kant and Hegel, mainly about the thought that Hegel completes Kant, all that kind of stuff. And this is the bit that may scare you all away and think, oh, well, I'd rather be doing something much more interesting. And then next week, we'll read, I find The Spirit of Christianity and Its Faith, that text, the best early Hegel that introduces the later system. So that text, and I'll tell you what bits of it to read, will form another kind of introduction and give us a leg up from the early Hegel, which is reads beautifully. It's just a gorgeous text. And tell us where we're going. Well, for me, the phenomenology is simply the most riveting text of philosophy ever written. It is unspeakably thrilling. And part of its thrillingness is that it is simply unlike any other philosophical text that came before it or indeed came after it. It has no followers, even by Hegel. And I'll say something about how I think the phenomenology is something that even slips out of Hegel's control, and that he is not in complete control of the argument, which is richer and exceeds, I believe, his own system. Well, what makes the phenomenology so gripping? Well, what Hegel does, as I guess great philosophers always do, is not answer old problems, or not directly, but they change the topic. They change the what we're talking about. And Hegel made, I guess, two moves that really changed the topic of what philosophy is even about, or could be about. And then there's a third move involved, which is significant for understanding how he achieved the other two. Well, let's begin with the obvious. Modern philosophy begins with the thought of self-consciousness, with the discovery of subjectivity, with the I think, therefore I am, that idea, that self-consciousness, right, is certain of itself, is the ground or foundation of possible other knowledge, that this idea of self-consciousness, of the discovery of subjectivity is, as I understand it, self-consciousness. That is, the relation of the self to itself as a condition for a possibility of relationship to the world is constitutive of what we mean by subjectivity. So to be a subject is to be in this self-conscious relation. Kant deepens the Cartesian thought with his notion of the transcendental unity of apperception, that is, with the thought that the I think must accompany all my representations, or otherwise something would be represented in me which could not be thought at all. The old B131132 jiggle. Hegel changes the subject. He contends that the minimal unit for there to be self-conscious agency is two. That you cannot be a self-conscious agent by yourself. You are not in an immediate self-relation to yourself. On the contrary, your relationship to yourself, you being yourself, is mediated by the other. So you are, in ways that we will discover, absolutely dependent on the other, absolutely dependent on what is not you. Now, one might suppose that that is enough of a break, but actually Hegel goes even further. For he doesn't think that two is enough. Maybe the minimal unit is two, but as every lover has always discovered, two is never enough. We always need a third. Run that thought any way you wish. So Hegel's definition of self-consciousness is the I that is a we, and the we that is an I. That is, his claim is going to be that instead of an I think, we are going to require a we think. And it's the notion of the we think that is implied or involved in his notion of Geist. The phenomenology of spirit is a phenomenology of Geist. Geist, or spirit, is the we that is an I and the I that is a we. So the idea that we are always involved in a community of some sort, Hegel calls language the Dasein of spirit. Well, if I could figure out what that meant, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be writing a great book. Language is the being there of spirit. It's the way in which, it's the medium through which a community, as it were, passes itself on, recognizes itself, talks to itself, so embeds itself. Now, this is extraordinarily thought that came to me independently of Hegel one day in that bar just opposite Columbia. Was it the West End Bar? Is that the old place where everyone goes to get? Yeah, that's it. Okay, so I was skipping my Greek class, and a friend and I were arguing about Freud, and I said, my problem with Freud is he suffers, and I'd read too much Whitehead in my youth, he suffers the problem of misplaced concreteness. He thinks the mind is in your head. And my friend said, where do you think mind is, if not in your head? And I said, here, between us. So Hegel has this notion of mindedness, or Geist, that somehow the mind is not in the head, not where the head is, or not to be located there, but somehow bound up in the practices and relations one has with one's others, who they might be. And I'm going to say who they are in a minute, because now here's Hegel's second move. You might think, well, that's enough already to get rid of the premise of modern philosophy, namely metaphysical and methodological individualism. That's the move here, that he destroys the idea that the fundamental unit from which we begin philosophy and through which we do philosophy is the standalone individual, the mind knowing itself, and says that the minimal unit is going to be some broader object. But then in the middle of his book, having already made that move, he says, well, what about this we think? Well, what is it we think? This we think instead of the I think. And what we think is not really flatly up to us. We can't think anything we want. In fact, we often get the feeling we can't think anything we want. Rather, there is, and here's the next new topic of conversation, history. That our community, our linguistic community, is conditioned by the language we have and the resources we have and the relations we have to one another are all conditioned by history. And to say they're conditioned by history is to say a bunch of things, figuring out what it means. But anyway, spirit is, Hegel says, it's history. And one of the things that means is this. That we are, right here and now, a community of the living and the dead. That the dead are always with us. And that we have to find adequate means of acknowledging in our collective and communal practices our relationship to the dead. This is what the famous chapter on Antigone, and then the even more famous chapter on absolute knowledge, are all about. How to live with the dead. So when Hegel says philosophy is its own historical epoch conceptualized in thought, he means unearthing the history that allows us to be here speaking in the way in which we do. That we are not only dependent on one another and on all this linguistic community, but we are dependent on the concrete history that got us here. Well, what bits of the concrete history? Well, Hegel's going to give us a story about that concrete history. A story that includes the Greek world, the Roman world, the absolute state, discussions of Aeschylus's, Sophocles' Antigone, Diderot's Rameau's nephew, the French Revolution, the nature of the guillotine, and so forth and so on. That is, suddenly now, philosophy is connected to non-philosophy, to what philosophy has no control over, to what you cannot know a priori or by reflection or anything like, but really, philosophy itself finds itself conditioned by things that are bits of concrete history, certain kind of history, but certainly concrete history. Now, in this, Hegel has almost no successors. I cannot think of any philosopher who included in the core of their thought the role of history as a condition for self-consciousness in the way that Hegel does. Heidegger, of course, pretends to, but and of course, the whole question is, what's the difference, right? And then the other side is Marx will argue against Hegel, not historical enough, right? So this is a fraught area. But the fraughtness is where the thrill is, because if Hegel is right, if he can convince us that you can't talk without the mediation of the other, you can't talk about the mediation of the other without talking about the we thing, and you can't talk about the we thing without talking about history, then those debates, let's call it the finessing of history, right, and Heidegger's story and the attempt to reduce philosophy to history, the Marx version, although it'd be another course. I think actually Marx is more philosophical than Hegel. Right? That's the fault of Marx. He's too philosophical, not historical enough. But however you do it, right? And of course the one person who's going to contest Hegel over this history, who's going to agree with him and disagree with him at every moment, is he believes destiny. Foucault. That was the name I was repressing. Okay. But Foucault got the point, right? He said what he believed. He knew what the stakes were, and what he too wanted to write a history of the present, but he had a different idea of what it meant to write a history of the present, but that's the stake. That's the stakes. And the right, as I'm concerned, the right stakes. My claim is that once you have gone through this Hegelian move, there's no going back. So if you don't want to make the move, this is a good time to leave. Whoa, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to have to read history too. Forget it. Then there's a third move, which is not novel, but which is fundamental, which is novel in the context of modern philosophy, and is fundamental to the Hegelian program. Everyone was trying to figure out how to get beyond Kant. What do we do about Kant? And I'll explain why Kant's such a problem in a moment. What do we do about Kant? And, of course, like all good nerds, in order to answer that question, they just kept reading more Kant. And finally, he helped them out by publishing the Critique of Judgment. And the Critique of Judgment contains a thought that had not really been uttered philosophically since the time of Aristotle. And that's the thought of organism. Hegel, early on, was impressed with Aristotle. And what he saw in Aristotle, and what he and Schelling and Hölderlin and all their friends, including the young romantic, I mean, everyone got out of the third critique, is a way of avoiding both atomism and formalism. Now, atomism and formalism go together. They go together in the following way. Atomism is the belief that there are irreducible particulars. Formalism is the belief that there are a priori universals. So the problem for the tradition, the problem that we know goes right back to Plato, is the relationship between universal and particular. And the thought is, well, if you've got these universals, if they're going to have any weight whatsoever, right? Then they are going to swallow up the particulars and therefore swallow up finitude, history, all the concrete stuff. But the other way is if you start with just particulars and say, ah, let's go with them, then you get nominalism,
relativism, and skepticism,
i.e. the debate between rationalism and empiricism, of which for the people following him, they read Kant as just another rationalist. As I'll say in a second, he's a kind of formalist. Now, the way in which they are going to answer this is not to think of a new or better relationship between universal and particular, although God only knows there's plenty about universal and particular all over Hegel. Rather, they are going to say that the primary relationship is not universal particular, but part to whole. And they are going to allow a dynamic view of a part-whole relationship. I've already said that I'm absolutely dependent on you. Well, that means I'm a part of a whole. And I've already said that two is not enough. Therefore, we are all parts of a wider communal linguistic community. And I've already said that that community is not self-sufficient. It's part of a history. So you see, the logic of part and whole is really a different way of trying to think about the fundamental ways of starting this thinking off. And that is going to run throughout it. And what's the issue will be, what's the mechanism for the movement of these relationships? How is it that individuals do not become mere parts of wholes and get swallowed up with them the way they used to get subsumed under universals? Nonetheless, the movement from part to whole certainly a structural movement in Hegel's thoughts. Okay, so those are the three moves, I think, that get Hegelian thought going. Well, let's put this in context. Namely, the movement from Kant to Hegel. We all know, or if you don't, I'm telling you right here and now, that Hegel is known as an absolute idealist. So it's some notion of absolute idealism, some idea of the unity of thought and being. Well, the question is, what's the relationship between absolute idealism and whatever its other is, namely formal or subjective idealism? Kant, formal or subjective idealist, Hegel, absolute idealist. In the preface to the Phenomenology, which, by the way, we will not be reading for another 28 weeks. I say the preface to last. I think it's just that incomprehensible until you've read the book. So, there you go. Hegel says in the preface, Miller numbers the paragraphs, and that's I'll use that as a helpful way of doing it. Paragraph 26. He says, one of his typical Hegelian phrases, pure self-recognition in absolute otherness. That's the phrase. Pure self-recognition in absolute otherness. This ether, as such, is the ground and soil of science, or knowledge in general. That's the kind of thing that, when I said, you know, the surface texture is hard, I meant that. Right? To be told that the texture, the ground, is
pure recognition, that doesn't take us very far.
Okay.
Well, here's at least one version of what that sentence means. By pure self-recognition, he means something like pure self-consciousness, so something like the transcendental unity of apperception. And by absolute otherness, he might mean something like what Kant calls things in themselves.
So he's saying that the goal and the ether and the ground of his endeavor is to show that the conditions for the possibility of self-consciousness are grounded in the relationship to things in themselves. The very thing that Kant said we could not know. How does he manage that? Okay. That's what I want to talk about for the next hour and a half.
This doesn't bore you nothing.
In a very simple way, the goal of Hegel is to complete Kant. For Hegel, Kant is a limited or subjective or finite idealist. As I have already suggested, he is going to replace the Kantian notion of the transcendental unity of apperception with his notion of spirit, which is already a community with a history. I mean, something very thin with something very fat. Well, the reason for calling Kant a subjective idealist is just the very terms of transcendental idealism. Namely, we know appearances only and not things in themselves. Well, let's unpack what that might mean. One way in which Kant spells out the notion that we know appearances only, not things themselves, is by contrasting our conceptual form of understanding. That is, the idea that our awarenesses of objects are always mediated by categories and concepts, that we know objects because they fall under and are mediated by empirical concepts and certain basic items called categories. That notion of awareness is compared to God's awareness, what he calls intellectual intuition. This is Kant. So intellectual intuition is the thought that God doesn't have to wait for something to affect his sensibility and then get a concept and figure out what it is and work it up and think about it. That is, God doesn't have to make judgments. God's act of thought is actually an act of creation. That no sooner does he think something than it exists. That for God, this is the crucial thought, I guess. The deficient, always, philosophers are always dull people. The crux of God is a modal issue. Right? For God, there are no unrealized possibilities. That is, there's no difference between possibility and actuality, and therefore no difference between possibility and necessity. That modal differentiations are only true of finite intellects. Okay, so Kant says there's a difference between our finite intellect and God's intellectual intuition. That means we have a limited perspective on the world, that we do not have a God's eye point of view. This is all something that everyone knows nowadays from Thomas Nagel, right? We do not have a view from nowhere. We only have a subjective perspective.
and therefore God or angels, there are angels in Locke's essay, they too are able to know, right? I mean, angels can know necessary connections, right? God and angels can know, only us finite beings can't know them. God and angels may know differently. Now, therefore, our knowledge is restricted or privative with respect to an infinite standpoint. Hegel's question is simply this. What are the grounds for posing this other standpoint? In posing this other standpoint, it makes a perspective we do not have, the God's eye point of view, constitutive of the meaning of the knowledge that we do have, and hence restricts the being of the world to what merely conforms to our subjective way of looking at it. So it's as if, the story goes, we are told that our knowledge is limited or finite because we cannot see things, right, the way God could see them. So compared to God, our position is restricted. And the question is, with what right can we pose this other standpoint as the condition of possibility for the intelligibility and meaning of our standpoint? So, if our knowing were not restricted or limited by contrast with intellectual intuition, it would not be finite in the restricted sense. It would be infinite. So there you go. All you have to do is say that there's no allowing talk of stuff you cannot know, and that already begins to make your perspective on the world not finite, but infinite. And this is what's going to motivate, and let's admit it, God is all over Hegel, right? God talk is there in abundance. And no one is going to say there's no God talk in Hegel. But the talk of God and religion in the phenomenology is in fact there to discuss this very issue, namely the issue of whether we can presume an externality, something that is absolutely unknowable and outside of us, as a condition for the intelligibility of the way in which we do think and know, right? So the move here is very akin to one famously made in analytic philosophy by Donald Davidson, right? Where he said, you know, people said, oh, our knowledge is only relative to our conceptual scheme, right? And then, you know, Davidson wanted to know whether there could be different conceptual schemes. And he made the argument, well, if we could understand one another, then the conceptual schemes couldn't be different. But then if conceptual schemes couldn't be really different, then it made no sense at all to say knowledge is relative to a conceptual scheme, because there's nothing to contrast it with. So the relativity disappears. Now, this is not to say that knowledge isn't conceptual, historical, you know, all of that. It's to say there's no reason to think that any of that is a restriction. Right? So this is just taking Kant at his word, right? Kant's great thought, his stupendous thought, the Copernican turn, is that the limits of knowledge are its conditions of possibility, and therefore not limits at all. Right? Well, what Hegel wants to do is radicalize that thought so that the thought that they are not limits at all cuts across all the versions of Kantian skepticism. So for Hegel, the problem with traditional metaphysics is not that it attempted to know the infinite. Why bother doing philosophy if you're not going to try to know the infinite? You know? If you're just going to do the finite, take a cooking course. There are just more valuable and interesting ways to spend your time, you know, if you want to know the finite. But rather, that it had offered a false interpretation of the infinite as something transcending the world of ordinary experience. So the idea of Hegelian philosophizing is to make everything, and I mean every goddamn thing that everyone ever thought might be transcendent to human experience, and show that it is immanent to human experience and gets its role in the role it plays within a part-whole logic, right? That it is wholly immanent. So of course there's God. But as we know, and this is what the great chapter of religion, Christianity, God becomes man. Not sort of. That's it. He just becomes man. Then man becomes the Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit dies. That's the story. End of story. That's the argument, right? So, now, this move, I think, is definitive of continental philosophy. Continental philosophy is distinguished by the attempt to show that each item that traditional philosophers have thought to be transcendent is really an immanent condition. And the question of continental philosophy, so all of continental philosophy is just doing Aristotle to Plato, right? What else is there to do? The Aristotelianized Plato. Bring those universals down to earth. Make them do some real work. Find them in the world. The question is for philosophy, modern philosophy, the kind of philosophy that Hegel started, is how far can you go without stopping doing philosophy at all? That is where you lose any possible grip on saying that the world has a structure or an intelligibility or a meaning, and you just get reduced, what, to kind of positivism and things like that. Right? So philosophy is that ticklish, difficult, almost impossible endeavor of bringing God down to earth without losing that thought that it is God who came to earth and not some, you know, wise guy who you met on a bar one night in a place in Brooklyn. Tough night last night. Okay. Second move.
This will have a break, so we need some air.
Let's think of the other ways in which Kant thinks about totality. Because these are all, again, trying to think about it's the Kantian thought of totality that makes his view of things subjective. And one of the ways in which Kant thinks about totality is the idea of an infinite progress or an infinite regress that is never completed. So when he talks about causality, he'll talk about
causal conditions. Each condition has another condition that goes back forever.
When he talks about his in his moral philosophy, he will talk about the highest good as an object of infinite striving, something, a regulative idea that we seek after in order to realize our virtue so that we may be deserving of what the proportion that in the highest good, happiness will be proportional to virtue. So in both cases, Kant supposes that finitude means no knowledge of totality. That there may be an infinite striving towards the goal, or an infinite thinking that moves back towards the unconditioned, but we never have an image of totality. Well, why? Well, in a way, Kant's thinking here is literal. He thinks if it was a totality, we'd have to be kind of outside it to kind of see it, so that the totality is something you can approach but never get, because, well, if you got there, you would already be outside it. And hence, the thinking would not be finite. Hegel will argue that the notion, this is going to yield his notion of the unhappy consciousness. That consciousness that continually is striving to be at one with something beyond it and never achieves it. He thinks that in order, once you know the limit, you have already crossed the limit. That is, you can't think the idea of limit without already going beyond it. That you can't make sense of the idea of a limit that is, I mean, think about what you used to think about when, used to think about as a kid, where does space end? And I don't know, it always ended in a big brick wall, right? Well, the brick wall always has, you know, I mean, it just never works. You can't think the notion of limit in the way that Kant wants to, right, without being self-defeating. Okay. Let's have a break there, since we're all, I can see, deeply into sweat. Let's have a real 15-20 minute break, let the room air out, people go outside. Can everyone just, 1 second, I want everyone in the class, you're going to get together and form study groups. So can everyone in the class raise their hand and take a look around you to who you know, and the idea is you know one person, they know one person, and you'll get groups of 4 or 5. Get together during the break. Form a group. Give me a slip of paper with your names on it. Okay, let's have a break.